Sarah Orne Jewett published her American classic, The Country of the Pointed Firs, in 1896, and it has remained a quiet evocation of the best of Maine. In a special edition published by Simon & Schuster, it is described as follows. It tells the story spanning 3 months' time in the life of a small coastal town called Dunnet Landing in 19th-century Maine. A lone female visitor arrives and finds lodging with the widowed Mrs. Todd, the town herbalist, who introduces the visitor to many of the town's inhabitants. The visitor's impressions of the people she meets start out simply, and then almost invisibly they crescendo into a deep, intense human portrait. When I read this book, I am moved by the wisdom hidden in the simplicity of the story. The portraits of the people, the likes of whom are today my friends and neighbors, known and unknown. For Jewett, the place described is a best scape for living, in nature, at work, for community. It is a place to see, hear, smell, taste, feel, love, and celebrate the best of what we call home. At the end, Jewett writes, near the woods, we could walk along to the highest point. There above the circle of pointed firs, we could look down over all the island and could see the ocean that circled this and 100 other bits of island ground, the mainland shore and all the horizons. It gave a sudden sense of space, for nothing stopped the eye or hedged one in. That sense of liberty and space and time which great prospects always give. What a perfect definition of the spirit of Maine. Thanks for listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm Peter Neal.
What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guests today are Sibberly Good, Richard Saltonstall, Jr., Curator of Maritime History, and Kevin Johnson, Photography Archivist at the Penobscot Marine Museum in Searsport, Maine. They are the organizing team for a new exhibit at the museum opening May 23rd, Memorial Day, this year, Sardine Land, a survey of the sardine herring fishery that flourished along the Maine coast towns from the 19th century to 2010, when the industry and all the cultural import engendered collapsed into mostly memory. The sardine harvest, packaging, and distribution was a worldwide phenomenon, and its collapse left behind an important aspect of Maine's cultural and physical landscape, another example of the spirit of Maine. Sibberly and Kevin, it's been a long time since we've seen each other. I'm very happy to welcome you here today. And I'm beside myself with excitement about sardines. I don't know what it is about the little things, but they, the history of them and the colorful part of it, the social history, and how something as vital and important can be there and shape a coastal culture and then disappear. Mm-hmm. So let's start a little bit with the biography of the two of you. Sibberly, how did you get here? Where do you come from?
I grew up in Vermont, but I went to Colby, and so I got to Maine, and I did a maritime studies program in college that just took whatever path I was going on, and it was a sharp left turn into maritime museums. So in order to finish my graduate school degree, I had to do two internships, and my second one was at the Penobscot Marine Museum. Got my foot in the proverbial door. And 7 years later, they hired me back to be part of the curatorial team. Just love maritime history, love Maine, and the match of sailing and the maritime history, and just really fascinated.
So before we move on to Kevin, talk to me a little bit about the special collections in Searsport that you oversee.
It's a little of everything, and that's great. So we've got the merchant marine, the families who went to sea, the memorabilia, the souvenirs they brought back, the paintings of their ships. There's that whole story. Then there's the fisheries. So lobstering, obviously, ground fishing, sardines and herring. That's amazing. And then the small boat collection, which is the history of going from sail and rowing to power. And so we get to tell that story. So those are our big themes.
We're going to come back to that. Kevin, we're under what rock? Out from under what rock did you crawl?
Well, I'm originally from the swamps of Jersey. I try not to tell that to too many people, but I escaped a long time ago. I went to college in Philadelphia and ended up becoming a paralegal by chance. And I was a paralegal for 14 years, but had become passionate about photography and started really getting into it and building my own darkroom. And at some point, I realized I needed to go to school to really do what I wanted to do. And moved to Maine in 2003 and attended the Maine Photographic Workshops year-long program. And then I was a teaching assistant for the same program for the next 2 years. In my bid to stay in that creative environment, they owned a large collection of glass plate negatives, which I was always curious about. But one day when I was in the library and the librarian had stacks of these glass plates on her desk, they were all from Greensboro, Vermont, which is a little town in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont where my family and I would vacation since the 70s. And it's a town that consists of a lake, an inn, and a general store. Yet there were 10 or 12 boxes of negatives of this town. And I was very curious, to say the least, and really taken with the photos, got to print them in the darkroom. And as fate would have it, this librarian person was leaving the school, and she set it up that I could take over doing what she was doing, which I soon found out was figuring out how to monetize this collection for the school because they were in financial trouble. But I learned how to digitize, I learned how to print, started a database, and during this time, the recession of 2006 hit. The school took a blow, and we were all laid off from our jobs, and they turned off the heat in Union Hall in Rockport Harbor. And people from Maine know what happens when you turn off the heat in winter without a good plan. And sure enough, the pipes broke. The collection was soaked, and I got a call on Super Bowl Sunday from a good friend who said, the collection is soaked. They're going to throw it all out. You got to get down here and see what you can do. And so I recruited some friends who were coming to my house to drink beer and watch the Super Bowl. And I convinced them to come with me down to Rockport that night. And we spent 6 hours taking out all these glass negatives from the basement of Union Hall and bringing them up to the dining hall, which was the only heated building at the left on the campus. And then I spent the next 6 weeks drying it out. During that time, the school changed hands. The new owners did not have an interest in this collection. It wasn't part of their vision, so it had to be donated. It had been donated to the workshops by the owners of Down East Magazine before, and therefore they had to donate it somewhere else, and they chose the Penobscot Marine Museum with the one condition that they take me with the collection and give me a job. You might remember that because I believe you were on the board around that time.
I was on the board at that time, and I said, why are we doing this? This is ridiculous. I loved it. Tell me about glass plate negatives. Okay. Just our audience won't necessarily know what were the difference of what we're talking about and challenges.
Some of the audience might not even be aware of what flexible film is like. Well, but in the early days of photography, they found out that glass was a good medium to put the light-sensitive silver gelatin on. And initially, they used glass in a wet plate as a wet plate solution, which was primarily used in the Civil War and maybe for a decade or so after. And that involved actually coating the silver gelatin on a piece of glass, putting it in a film holder, into the camera, tripping the shutter, and then getting it into a developer all before that emulsion dried. So you needed to have your dark room right next to where your camera was. Exposures were really long. Stunning, because these pieces of glass were quite large. But if anything was moving in them, that would not be seen or would be heavily blurred. But very sharp, full of detail. And then later they developed a way of making a dry plate, so you didn't have to have your darkroom right there, and it really freed up photographers to take their film or glass plates into the landscape and shoot and process later.
What's the quality difference in the image, let's say, over that period of time from the glass plate negative to the successor?
So the glass plates came in various sizes, as small as 2 1/4 inches and a quarter inch by 2 1/4 inch, up to 4 inches by 5 inches, 5 by 7 inches, 8 by 10 inches, 11 by 14 inches, and even some cameras that could take a 16 by 20 plate. So we're talking a huge piece of film, if you will. And if you think of it and compare it to 35mm photography, your negative in that scenario would be about the size of a postage stamp. And if you take a piece of glass that's 5 by 7 inches, how many postage stamps can you put on it? That shows you how much resolution is in a plate of that size, which allows you to zoom in and see details that would not otherwise be available.
And if you print them today, medium side by side, the resolution of the glass plate is perceivably better, sharper, with more depth, more document, more feeling.
For sure. And the lenses were better. Many people are taking amazing photos now with their phone, but you think about it, a phone doesn't really even have a lens. And these older view cameras had really impressive lenses.
Okay. We'll come back to it. Penobscot Marine Museum, this is a very good example. You have this photography collection, which is expanded, and we'll talk about that more as we get along. But it's bigger, it's special, and it's basically unique. There's no museum that I know that has such a focused collection within exactly what within one medium. You also have other secrets that the public probably isn't aware of. And the one, of course, I always point to are the marine paintings.
Right. So we've got the Buttersworths, which is a British artist, but we also have local. We just got a FitzHenry Lane of a Maine lumber schooner, which you can see how they're sailing it. You see the men on board. So that's amazing. A picture's worth 1,000 words. And there you can see the act of the people doing it. And then we have amazing local artists, Carol Thayer Berry, Stubbs, and Sanborn. And so these paintings are amazing for, again, showing the people on board, the ports they visited around the world. So yes, they're beautiful art, but they also, again, can help tell the story of what life was like.
But people need to know that they're there.
Yes.
It's the way they are now. I mean, in some ways I like it because you're in an old building. You're climbing some narrow stairs. You step into a room that used to be a scullery or something. Mm. And suddenly there are these magnificent marine paintings that the other great maritime museum in the United States and elsewhere would die to have. Mm-hmm. And they don't get seen as much as they should be. And it's a little treasure trove that's out there. And this would be a good time for me to exhort all of you to go to this museum and see it. Don't just drive by. Mm-hmm. The sidewalks are done. The road is open. There's places to park. And it's really would be important for the museum now to have a revival of interest to take advantage of these special collections that have been there for a long time. Let's turn now to Sardine Land. This is a big one for you. This is, what's the history of that? How did it come to pass?
We were having a planning session to look ahead and pick out some topics that we wanted to focus on for upcoming exhibits. And we always pick a theme for each season that we'll focus on. So we'll have our exhibits that stay put, and then we have a new exhibit that we introduce and tell a story, and that will typically last for a season. Because of the amount of material we have related to the sardine industry, that floated to the top of ideas, and we decided that we had enough material that we should do a two-season exhibit. So that's what we're doing.
Two seasons changing halfway?
We might add a couple more things next year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of what you're going to show over the next months, how much of that had been on view before?
Back in 2010, when I first got here, when the last cannery just closed, there was a little mini exhibit on sardines. But this is our chance to really bring things out and showcase it.
Mm-hmm. And that initial exhibit had a lot more focus on the catching of sardines and less on what came after they were caught.
Mm-hmm. So this exhibit will be process, mm-hmm. fishing, catch, process,
correct,
distribution.
Yeah, it's two parts. So one is the people who worked in the canneries and really focusing on their stories, their experience. Sure, we'll show the table where they worked, but it's more about the people. Mm-hmm. And then there's the fishery side, more about the boats, because there's some iconic sardine carriers out there to recognize. So that goes a little more into the how do we catch them, the different types, how that's evolved over time.
So you've got the concept. Now you have to inventory what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Did you actually know how much you had?
Right now I have a volunteer doing an official finding aid, mm-hmm. but we had a good idea. But of course, in doing that, we're uncovering more to tell the story. But we have the Maine Sardine Council records and the R.J. Peacock Canning Company records. So we knew we had some good meat on the bone, mm-hmm. and then the cans. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't hard to gather it together, but we're going to come out of it knowing how much more we have and all the interconnections to the industries.
The labels are this extraordinary history of graphic art, 19th century, early 20th century graphic art. They are colorful. They are brilliantly drafted and conceived. They make modern advertising look silly.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have a wall of sardine cans, and not as many as I'd love to have, but it'll give you a pretty good indication of how extensive this industry was from Portland's up to Eastport.
Well, that, and then, of course, let's start on the other side of that. Let's start in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they come from?
Right.
Where do they come from?
We've had herring off the coast. They migrate back and forth. They were smoking them and pickling them in the 1820s, even further with the Wabanaki. The Passamaquoddy knew how to catch the herring. But they're finding all those juveniles, and they said, there's so many, there's got to be a market. And so that's how they came up with canning them in oil as sardines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they had the adult fish out there, but it's sort of Maine put itself on the map with just these schools of juveniles that they could can. And that's the birth of the industry.
So that's where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
They passed through this sort of financial, social process. And then where'd they go?
Everywhere.
So it's great. An international trade.
Mm-hmm. And we have cans that were marketed just to the south with Possum brand. And then they're trying to break into the Mexican market. Mm-hmm. And they're competing with the Norwegians and the French for this market.
Europe, Norway, they were competing, or did they actually get shipped over to Europe and consumed by Spaniards?
I think that was the harder market to break into, and that's where the Maine Sardine Council was started in the 1950s to try to compete and break into those markets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there's enough here in the United States. Everyone for lunch back in the day had a can of sardines, a sleeve of crackers, maybe some mustard and cheese, and that was your lunch.
That was your lunch, yeah.
And it brings up that distinction that Maine sardines are not sardines at all. They're herring or juvenile herring. And the real sardines are from the Mediterranean and Sardinia. And I think people from that area of the world would turn their nose up at Maine, quote unquote, sardines. So there was some things to overcome in terms of marketing.
And photography was very much a part of it.
It was. And our photo collections are rich in the subject. The pastime itself is interesting. There's the catching of them, the canning is photographically interesting. But even in the early days when they were primarily using wares, and there's so many old photos that just have a fishing ware in it, because it's like a work of art in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sardine Council, because of what they were doing and promoting the industry, they needed a lot of photos, and they hired some of the best photographers to take those photos, which led to my introduction to Casti Rahoma, because when I first started at the museum, going through the Maine Sardine Council collection for the first time, I came across all these sheets of 120 film with the stamp on the back, you know, Casti Rahoma. Well, who is Casti Rahoma? I was quickly directed to talk to a woman named Diana Bonner Ganter up at the Maine State Museum, who had been working on his biography for almost 25 years at this point. I told her that I found this load of negatives, and she was down the next day, and I learned a whole lot about Costi then. But the photos that he took really just stood out, and he was hired by the Maine Sardine Council to document the industry from ware to can. And so he was out at the Dix Island Ware watching them haul and close off the pocket, and Jacob Pike shows up and pumps out full of herring, and then goes back to the Holmes Packing House in Rockland, and then all the different components that went into packing a can of sardines gets documented by Costi in a very beautiful way.
If you're just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists, makers and exemplars, whose creative work is a compendium of an artistic response to the landscape in which we live. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, and streaming and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Cipriley Good and Kevin Johnson, curators at the Penobscot Marine Museum and organizers of Sardine Land, a new exhibit at the museum, open through the summer, that uses objects and photographs to evoke the colorful history of the herring sardine fishery that flourished in Maine as precursor to the lobster industry we know today. Tell me just a little bit about the history of the acquisition of the Sardine Council archive. How did that happen?
So they closed in 2000, the council did. They had given us some things back in 1998. I think they were closing the main office, so needed a place to put the archives. And then we got a second round of materials after the official closing. Mm-hmm.
Directly from the last director, Jeff Kalin.
Right.
And is that before or after the museum got the National Fisherman?
Before.
It was before. And when you went...
But after they got the Atlantic Fisherman.
So talk just a little bit about that. I mean, these were basically trade newspapers.
Correct.
And they weren't read beyond the trades, in the sense that people didn't read them for news or local news, even other than how it pertained directly to the trade in the particular area they lived. But you acquired those too, and why? At the time, what was the rationale?
Well, obviously, it was before my time, but in the early 90s, when Atlantic Fisherman was evolving into the Maine Coast Fisherman and then eventually the National Fisherman, that last editor, Gardner, I believe his last name was, broke up what they had at Atlantic Fisherman and brought it to us, as well as to the St. Anne Museum down in Gloucester. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And tried to like divvy it up in terms of location. Of the photos. Most of Maine and Canada came to us, and most of the more southern parts went there. But it was a treasure trove. I mean, it is history. It contains tons of images of boats of various types that were being developed to target different species of fish or seafood. So all that ends up being totally documented. And because you have the actual journal itself, you can match up the photos that you have to an article and get the whole nine yards of information about it.
Yes, the articles, the text, commentary, columns that went from issue to issue.
Correct.
It's full of really good information. If you're interested.
Solid information,
really,
too.
Really, solid but colorful, too.
I Correct.
Mean, there's a character that's built into the perspective. We're going to come back to that because I want to talk to how that relates to the larger idea of the spirit of Maine. But to think that in these, there's the reportage, There's the actual market. Mm-hmm. There's the functionality. And then let's move a little bit into the social history. This was a very different kind of fishery in the sense that it entailed the whole family. Mm-hmm. Is that in your exhibit? Do you emphasize that in the exhibit?
I think owner-operator is such a main part of our sense of Maine, is that you own the boat, you own the weir. Sure, you might hire some guys to help you fish the weir, but it's your livelihood right there on the beach and you take care of it. Or that's your boat. You're not answering to the man, mm-hmm. you know. So very much it's about the families.
And then there were the women and children, and they found their place too.
Right. And in the canneries, there's this great quote we got where when the whistle blew that the fish were in, the husband goes off to catch the fish, and the woman starts humming because she knows she's going to get to go to the cannery and make money canning them. So. Mm-hmm.
And were the children involved as well?
Way back before there was child labor laws. there's pictures. It's not Lewis Hines, but it's sort of that idea of the little kids with these huge knives, you know, chopping up the herring for the cans.
Mm-hmm. I do believe Lewis Hines did go to Eastport and Lubeck and prove that children were being
abused.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. But I always heard that that one of the reasons children were desirable in the canneries because they had little fingers,
right? Mm.
So they could pack the cans, and I hope you have this in the exhibit. But in there's a sardine museum in Stavanger, Norway, and they have the tables there where the women used to come, and the cans would come down, and the fish would come down, and they would pack them, and all the rest of it. And they have the cans, and then they have these tiny little wooden fish. Mm. And you get to time yourself of how much time does it take to lay so many fish that into the can so it's perfectly packed and ready to go for the lid. But try it.
Right.
It's not easy. I don't care how many times you're asked to do it. And little fingers... my little fat fingers, I was terrible at it. Mm-hmm. But little fingers, I think, could be quite useful.
Yes.
That is part of the exhibit, so.
Oh, good. Oh, good, because it's fun.
And people will have a chance to
try to pack one.
Yes.
Right, right. And, you know, this isn't work. Excuse me. This is truly work from the beginning all the way to the end. It's
For sure. It's
a chain of labor.
And the women that worked as packers often had the choice of making an hourly wage, which would have been minimum wage, and we know what minimum wage was way back when, or they could get paid piecemeal. And if you were fast, you could make 2-3 times more than minimum wage as a packer by being fast.
Mm-hmm. Were there innovations along the way? What were the innovations that...
Sure. So going from... mechanization and a conveyor belt going from one to the next. And then the big innovation was instead of the women cutting, they had machines and you could cut them frozen. So you didn't have to have the fresh fish coming in. Mm-hmm. They could come in frozen. And so I think another big innovation was they used to make cans by hand. So there's a whole cohort of men who made the cans. Mm-hmm. And then the American Can Company came in and they made them, and those men lost their jobs, but the women kept them because they're still cutting and packing. Mm-hmm. So it really became women ran the factory and you didn't need as many men, which is kind of interesting for down east.
And the way they caught them also evolved as well. I mean, in the early days with having a weir, you had a stationary set up and you just waited for the fish to show up. Yeah.
Right.
And then it evolved to seining off a cove where you would take a net and literally cut off a cove once the sardines were in it. And you would have them trapped there and then you could fish them out. And then that evolved into literally chasing them with seine nets in the open ocean. And they became really good at it. In fact, probably too good.
Mm-hmm.
As with many fishing industries,
They overfished. Is that part of the decline, that they there was too much supply?
I think
too much.
Part of
too efficient
fishing. Too efficient for fishing, and eventually they're going to trawlers, where you're ripping up the bottoms with the trawlers, you're catching them. There's no place for the fish to hide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They can't hide down below. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the foreign factory ships out on Georgia's Bank wiped out that stock. You can find them wherever. And then with the lobster bait, the canneries closed, and then the lobster industry takes off, and they need bait, and herring's the perfect bait.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so supply couldn't meet demand. So mm-hmm. that's really where the stocks just couldn't keep up
mm-hmm.
with the lobstering industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's the condition of that now? What's the...
Noah, it's great. Noah says that they're not currently overfished mm-hmm. and they're in a rebuilding phase. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky to read what they're actually saying. But they're saying they're no longer overfished, but they're heavily... regulating them to help build the stocks back up.
Hmm.
And they've already made a couple comebacks. So,
mm-hmm. For people like myself who are confused, what's the difference between a herring and an alewife?
Well, an alewife is a herring, but it's a different species of herring that goes up into fresh water to
mm-hmm.
spawn.
Mm-hmm. It's about that time of year as we record. And it may be too late for people to hear this admonition, but if you have a chance, for goodness sake, go find one of those ladders where the alewives are coming back home. It's one of the most beautiful things you will ever see in nature.
Mm-hmm.
The scale of the return, the difficulty of the return, the profligacy of the return, the beauty of the animals returning is just, it's just emotionally incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And it if you want to take your children to get a glimpse of what nature can be, take them and show them the alewife return before mm-hmm. next year. And
one of the best places is Damariscotta Mills.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
They have a beautiful fish ladder that they recreated, and they get a very strong run of fish, and it's filled with, the air is filled with seagulls and osprey and eagles.
Fine.
There are seals that come right up into the river. The Native Americans used to say that the herring are the fish that feeds all.
Mm-hmm. There's a place in Soamesville. On Mount Desert, same thing. And if you want to go see eagles, just go sit by the Soamesville Library and watch the eagles fight amongst themselves. Forget about everybody else.
Yeah.
What about moving pictures? Do you have an archive of cinematography?
We don't have an archive, and we work with the Northeast Historic Film, and we get moving pictures donated to us, we'll often move them up there in the same way that they'll move down still images to us that they get. This exhibit will feature some moving pictures and some, I think, what will be very entertaining ones for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's year two, is that back in 2010, they had someone go in and document the closing of the cannery, the last Stinson in Prospect Harbor. But that was never finalized. And so we're hoping in year two we'll get that documentary complete and mm-hmm. we can show it.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, we'll be showing a short film called Champ 5 about one of the sardine packers named Rita Willie. And mm-hmm. that's a great story. And we've also received some 16mm film that after we leave here, I'll be dropping off at Northeast Historic Film to digitize for us. That includes several of the sardine packing contests, and some other material related to that.
Rita who?
Say Rita Willie.
And tell me a little bit about her.
Yes, this is a great story. This was one of the brilliant ideas of the Maine Sardine Council. Every year they would have this seafood and lobster fest in Rockland, which they still have, and they decided to invite all the canneries to send up their fastest packers to compete on a stage in front of a crowd.
Mm-hmm. Hot dogs in Coney Island.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the first one happened in 1970, and we have a lot of photographs of it, and bleachers filled with people, news people, the whole nine yards, and this woman, Rita Willey from Rockland, won the first one, and she ended up winning five more times between 1970 and 1983, and that was the last time that they had one of these contests. And it's just quite a scene. The women have their fingers taped up to prevent cuts, or they're taped up over cuts, and working as fast as they can, each having their own little style of how they do it. Competitive, but they're all equal in a way. You know, these are all, they all kind of had this essentially a menial job, but this actually elevated them and their self-worth, I think. It's their pride. Rita told a story that after she won her first contest, her sister, who also was a Packer, said to her, "I think I could beat you." And Rita coldly responded to her, "Put your scissors where your mouth is."
Are there variants, by the way, of packing styles? I mean, are all the tails to the south forever and all time, or do some people...
They would cross-hatch them. Uh-huh. So you got points for the mm-hmm. most beautiful pack.
The presentation was part of it.
Part of it, yeah. So you could innovate. If you came up and you had this brand new way of laying out the fish in the can...
To get the most in the can.
She attributed it partly to her stance, which would almost like a runner's stance, like one foot slightly forward, and keeping her hands low to the can as opposed to bringing anything up higher, because you just had to move it that much more. The closer you were to the can, the quicker you could get them in there. And as she said, she could, you know, do it in the dark. Like, that's how...
Easy it was.
Well, yeah, it was like a dance. It was like a dance. So you'd watch all the women on the line, and they each have their own dance. So they're, and it's a social event. They're chatting with their neighbor across the way, but their hands are flying. Mm-hmm. And we had a great quote from one of the guys who's moving the fish for them, saying, "I was afraid to get near them with their scissors. You know, they were just, the hands were flying."
Yeah, right. And you don't want to break their focus.
No,
that's for sure. No. Music. Was there music associated with all of this?
Oh, we haven't found that as much.
I mean, when you think about it, did they sing? Did the women sing? They gossiped, but did they sing?
It was rather loud in there. Mm-hmm. In these more modern mm-hmm. fish factories. I mean, there was machinery running. So I haven't heard about singing.
How about other types of associated folklore? The labels are collectibles, for example.
Right.
For sure.
Advertising cards, anything else that is a kind of folkloric material remnant, cultural remnant?
Well, I think culinary-wise, Ray's Mustard up in Eastport was developed for the mustard for the canning process. And they would take home the jugs of mustard that had the fish oil in after the fact and use it at home. And then, of course, now Ray's has all these gourmet mustards, but they started directly related to the cannery.
Yeah. If you haven't visited the Ray Mustard Mill, that's another place every Mainer should go. And to understand that this was an enormously powerful economic engine, and it... relied on a crop that is not hardly raised in Maine at all, the mustard seed. And I once asked the proprietor of Ray's Mustard, who was in the legislature at the time, where do you get your mustard seed? And they said, well, it's imported from Canada or the Philippines or something. And I said, well, my goodness, you have all these fields out here. What about bringing back the mustard seed industry in Maine? And he looked at me and started to think about the champagne mixture or something else. But again, mustard was therefore something simple, but part of an essential livelihood in the state of Maine, mm-hmm. employing all kinds of people, mm-hmm. feeding their families, giving them work to do, and it's all gone. All gone. I mean, right. Yes, we're making raised mustard, but the seed is coming from, you know, Shangri-La.
Right.
And they're not going into sardine cans anymore.
And they're not going into sardine cans anymore, no. Right? They're going into shelves in gourmet shops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, all well and good, but it's different.
It is.
The folk element of it, of course, always is the sort of folk life part. I was once involved in some exhibits where we were trying to document the collapse of the fishing villages in New Brunswick, and there was a time when those were vibrant fishing villages, and then all of a sudden, for various reasons, they collapsed,
mm-hmm.
and the villages were derelict mm-hmm. for the longest time, and now they've recovered, and partially why? Because artists have come back to take over the old derelict buildings
mm-hmm.
and to sort of use their imagination to readdress the folklore and the vitality of the historic period.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to look for artifacts for an exhibit in New York, up there we couldn't find any for the longest time. There just didn't exist because there had been no respect for the material culture because it was a story of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you went to Norway mm-hmm. and you were looking at the same thing, where those villages, codfish particularly, those villages had flourished because they had, one, decided to fish cooperatively and with limits.
Mm-hmm.
So their culture carried on. And it was the artifactual history of it was just rich as it can be, all aspects of it, because it was revered as something that had sustained them beyond a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists, makers and exemplars, whose creative work is a compendium of an artistic response to the landscape in which we live. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, and streaming and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Cipperly Good and Kevin Johnson, curators at the Penobscot Marine Museum and organizers of Sardine Land, a new exhibit at the museum, open through the summer, that uses objects and photographs to evoke the colorful history of the herring sardine fishery that flourished in Maine. It brings us, I think, a little bit to this whole idea that I always try to get to at the end, is this concept of what's the spirit of Maine. And it's a very elusive thing. May not even exist. But how would you talk about this phenomenon in the context of something that binds us all together in time and place?
I think the main ethos of hardworking folk who aren't afraid to get dirty. So these are guys doing really hard work. But the dignity that Kevin was talking about. Again, that mom and pop operator, it's the owner operators, the smaller, the Weirs, the Purseiners against those out of state and foreign factory ships.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, like, we're against those guys from Massachusetts
mm-hmm.
kind of mentality. This idea of Maine's extractive economy, which up and down the coast. So this happens to be herring, but it could be the granite, the logging, anything. So we're living off the land. It's right there in front of us. And that idea of seasonal labor, and a lot of Mainers have three jobs going. And so same with these people. They're working in the canneries spring to fall. And then the winter you have another job or you're drawing unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do multiple jobs to make a living
mm-hmm.
up here in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington County, the economic driver of this industry for Washington County was amazing. It made it thrive. And right now, they're kind of lost. What do we do now? We've got the blueberries. We've got the tipping. We've still got the fisheries. But sort of the bottom dropped out of the economy. And what's going to revitalize? And so they're dealing with, what do we do next?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're not so sure about those tourists.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of that listening to people.
Oh, expand on that, but also expand on that. You said you were listening to people. Did you survey? Did you go out and talk to people?
Right. So we did a listening session in Lubeck and in Belfast. And they're two different stories because Belfast was able to pivot. We now have Front Street Shipyard. We had MBNA. They were able to find jobs. Mm-hmm. Up in Eastport, they don't want to be the next Bar Harbor. Mm-hmm. They don't want that coming for them. These people are moving in and changing the culture. You know, get off my beach, they're private property. The working waterfront is in danger maybe because people from away are coming in and want to change the character. And so they're reckoning with, what do we do?
Did you find, because it's there, if you look for it, there's a kind of a new set of industries. There's seaweed harvest.
Right.
Or sustainable seaweed. Mm-hmm. There's aquaculture.
Yes.
There are new species, novel species that could best possibly add to the recipe of what we can offer from the ocean. So it doesn't all have to be either or, does it? I mean, these are jobs that young people in sort of this context of the new blue economy. Mm-hmm. I went to a memorial service the other day and they had a sidebar of oysters. And these are all, the farmers are all young. They're all under their 35 years of age. Mm-hmm. And they're working just like the thing. They're innovating. Mm-hmm. They're very proud of, for example, there's several oyster farms now that have no plastic, that they are basically plastic-free harvested oysters, which is... shows you that there is viability in the Renaissance.
Yes. And the heartening thing was someone in their 20s spoke up and said they were really excited about the dulse, that the dulse was coming back and there was that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. it was really nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see it in the farming industry. I mean, you have now a third generation of back to the land. I mean, you have the original people, then you had the sort of my generation movement that came back and sort of idealist came out of leftic politics and all the rest of it. But now you have a whole new iteration of young people in their 20s that are not only are they starting up new organic farms, but they're innovating in value added. That's part of the spirit of Maine. Mm-hmm. This idea that you're going to innovate. The ocean, the fecundity of the ocean is infinite. Mm-hmm. It is a source of enormous amount of productive power. And we can do it under many of the tenets of the old ethos, hard work, invention, multiple tasking, all that kind of thing. Do you make any predictions in the exhibit? Do you talk about the future?
There's a whole talk back section, and so we're inviting people to come back and tell us their ideas. Mm-hmm. This is a universal story. It's not just herring. It's the coal industry. It's any extractive industry. And so what is the revitalization when, for some reason, whatever has been the sustaining industry in your town goes away? Mm-hmm. And so that's the hope.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a calendar of programs that we should talk about?
October 4th, put it on your calendar, that's Sardine Fest. And so it's going to be a whole day in Searsport. I'm going to have people come in and talk. I have there's a comic book that was developed as part of the Maine Sardine Council. We have someone coming to talk about why would you make a comic book about that? But there's also during that day, we'll have taste testing. So what's your favorite way to eat sardines? And we're going to have music and kids' activities, and maybe we'll rope in some sardine packing champions to come tell us about that. So a day full of stories and meeting the people who are associated with the industry. It's not totally dead. They're still around and hear their stories.
Now, will this exhibit find its way into its sort of a permanent exhibit in the sort of the reorientation or reconception of the museum going forward?
Totally. So we have a gone fishing exhibit, which is about conservation. And so this is a huge part of that story. Maybe it'll take over the whole fisheries exhibit, but it'd be great to travel it in pieces up and down the coast mm-hmm. and get people in.
Of course, at one point, Kevin, you and I talked about exhibits from the museum's historical photography collection, and you were on your way, I think, to have an exhibit in every county, in every historical society, based on the photographs, historical photographs that you have in the collection. How far along are you?
Well, the county idea had only to do with Eastern, and we're halfway in terms of covering the state and its counties with the exhibits. We've been pretty successful in giving exhibits multiple lifelines because we'll develop an exhibit and have it on display during the season. And the last thing I want to do is take all that work and effort and shove it away in a closet or dismantle it. So we try to move our exhibits after they're on display in our museum to other places that can host them and do talks and have them on display for a period of time. And that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. We did lose the Hutchinson Center recently as a place that always had two of our exhibits on a regular basis, but maybe that will come back. Who knows?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about photography. Nothing is an original except the original. But you have multiples that can go on forever. Curriculum. There is a kind of homegrown story that can translate into a curriculum on that's both historical and social and scientific in a way. How is the educational effort going on at the museum?
They're great. I think the pivot is from that sort of, we used to have suitcases that went out, mm-hmm. and it's pivoting more to bringing people onto campus, mm-hmm. Funding the buses to get people there, and looking at redeveloping our website as a whole, not have a special education-only website, but sort of integrate that throughout so that you can find pieces in the classroom to support whatever topic you want to, that's maritime related.
Yeah. I have another job. People here are probably tired of hearing about it, but it's this World Ocean thing. And we have a section called Online Exhibits. And I would invite you, if you have exhibits that are built around this, a kind of composite digital exhibit, would you share it? And I can share it. And we have people looking at those exhibits, and in some ways they are downloadable and could be put up in libraries or in school lobbies or in other places that would extend the life of that exhibit far, far beyond both in time and space.
Sounds like a great opportunity for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's next at the museum? Let's talk about that a little bit before we finish.
Oh, we've gone through and redone our boat barns, but we have one last, our canoe exhibits, which there's this great thread. We have some great Wabanaki birch bark canoes, and they're still building them today. And seeing that through line of Wabanaki gets commandeered by the Anglo-Americans, and it's going back to the Wabanaki. So I'd love to tell that story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Well, the photography collection keeps growing. If we don't get another photo in, I would still have more than enough to do for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's been educational in itself in terms of how do we deal with this quantity to the point of my initial... When I first started as a photo archivist, I thought everything had to be digitized and made available. Some reality has set in, and now it's really picking the cream out of the crop as what you show, but making people aware that it goes beyond that, too. One of the ways we're doing that is we are having a new online database software developed. We've gotten into it about 6 months ago, and it's been a very painful process for us, but we hope when we get through the painful part, it's going to be a much more engaging way to explore all of our collections, not just photography, but all collections and archives.
Oh, museum-wide?
Museum-wide.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Any other exhibits in plan, smaller or different, other than you've already started to redo the small boat
shed. We have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always ongoing. I think we're sort of, our permanent exhibits, and I have air quotes there, nothing's ever permanent. Mm-hmm. So just freshening those up. And then, mm-hmm. like you said, we have this huge collection that doesn't always get out on display. So there's always some new seasonal exhibit to put up.
There is a brick building on Main Street in which you've had exhibits in the past. It's an obvious place for a kind of expansion, physical expansion. fraught with peril and expense. If that were refurbished, would it give you something that you don't have now, which would be an indoor space, year-round indoor space, exhibit space, classroom space? The potential of the museum is delimited a little bit by the fact that it's a campus of historic buildings that don't get moved and really can't be changed on the outside, and that's all good in one sense. But there's so much information in the museum demands to be set free, not just in maybe a new physical, expanded physical place, but through digitalization and a kind of educational, communicational mission my personal feeling is that all small museums and regional museums are going to have to go there. We're all facing the same challenges and recent issues with the federal and state support of museums just brings it into a sharper focus. I lament that, but on the other hand, isn't it an opportunity? It's a time to actually say, should we go beyond the conventional? Is it a possibility now that we can turn the historic house or we can turn this incredible collection that has so many ways of interpretation into something that then creates the added value and the understanding that goes along?
I think we need to do a better job describing what we have so that researchers, visitors can find it on the website. So I think that's the focus. And then just have a wonderful programming space. That's what we're missing, is a place to gather people together. So I think that's where we want to expand.
Mm-hmm. One of our dilemmas is we have more buildings than we have full-time staff people. And because so many of those buildings are historic, they constantly need attention, roofs, heating, the whole nine yards. So money always dictates to some extent what we could do. I mean, obviously, if money was no issue, I think there'd be more things that we could do. But we want to be able to do well with what we have. And hopefully success by more people coming and finding us will lead to other opportunities and allow us to grow.
Well, this ethos that we're talking about is a huge challenge. There could be a lot of resistance to change. But it doesn't change the sort of inherent value of the historical narrative. And it speaks to the demography of the state, the social hierarchy of the state, the history of technology, geography and community development, and all the kind of related services. And we see it all around us still, even as small new industries or new ideas come into our state society. You begin to realize that we should be collecting for that future too. Mm-hmm. And the museums are the place where that is going to happen. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I urge everyone to go to Sardine Land and be prepared to come home with your fingers oily.
We know where you're
oily
going.
Oily and fishy.
Yes. But no cuts.
And no cuts. And have a really wonderful time. Thank you, Shipperly. Thank you, Kevin.
Peter, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Shipperly Good and Kevin Johnson, curators at the Penobscot Marine Museum, Searsport, Maine. My guest next time will be Maxwell Rhine, a student of historic preservation. And we're going to talk about historic houses and how they protect a vital history of Maine in an unexpected way. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal.